All right. Now an observation. I think that some, at least, of the misconception about original sin has come from inadequate teaching. Inadequate in somehow conceiving sin as, well, we even use expressions, didn't we, or don't we, about the stain on the soul. And now there's no doubt that a child born into the world is sinful. Nevertheless, in strict theology, the far better way of approaching original sin is to speak of it as a deprivation of something that should be there, rather than of some kind of a positive evil. You see? Moreover, and still on original sin, the distinctions we made between the original sin of nature and the original sin of persons, we must give much more attention than we have been giving. And not, as I noticed, I think it's the Harcourt Brace series, forget, is the fourth year book on original sin, which has one paragraph. Am I correct? Please? First year has one paragraph on original sin. Well, that's not enough. And then it's botched up. But I do think that having explained original sin, there are two stresses that I think are called for in the teaching of original sin. Not to be so preoccupied with examining what is it, because frankly, in the last analysis, it's a mystery. But the first stress, its effects. Now, its most important single effect is the loss of integrity. In other words, the presence of concupiscence. Now that's real. All the irrational drives that we've all got. Have you ever thought what a terrible thing it would be if people, your best friends, knew all that you were thinking about? I couldn't face the world. Now fortunately, as faith also tells us, while all these crazy, irrational ideas, the urges, you name it, we've got it, they are not, though they are part of our nature, notice concupiscence is part of our nature. The only nature we've got is a fallen nature, redeemed no doubt, but still lacking that which it would have had man not sinned. In other words, to dissociate it, is this an important distinction? To dissociate all these crazy ideas, these stupid desires, the most bizarre notions that people get, from the real me. Do you know what I'm saying? Now, the really nasty thing the reformers did, I mean those who, with such sincerity as they had, tried to reform the church, and got into all kinds of deep, dark caverns. But one of the mistakes they made was to identify these crazy thoughts, these insane desires, with man's nature in such a way that this is original sin. And they identified man as man with this, forgetting, and what a forgetfulness, that the real I, or the real me, is the me who makes decisions. It's not the mad thoughts that I've got that makes me me, it's the mad thoughts that I either give in to or that I overcome. Of course, we've got good thoughts too. At any rate, the first stress, in other words, to teach original sin rather in terms of its effects, in terms of concupiscence. And secondly, we must put more stress than we have on the sinfulness of the society from which we came, or better, our parents came. Let's face it. Their background, their lives, and their ancestors' lives, somehow we inherit, somehow, and especially and obviously, the society into which we are born. In other words, there's a history of sin which affects me as an individual, as a person, which is over and above the original sin with which I am born as a human being. In other words, there are two kinds of original sin. One that I inherit when I come into the world as a man, and the other that I inherit because I am this man, this person. Third, how can concupiscence be explained in today's terminology? Well, hopefully, explained as the dualism in nature and person, though I wonder what you would do with this in the third grade. I'd like to know, by the way, how you would do it. To express this simply, our group tried to work out an explanation to use in teaching religion. Let's share it. Quote from St. Paul, "What I will I do not." No. Start over again. "What I will to do, I do not. What I don't want to do, that I do." Fine. Okay. That's it. Again, we would ask students to explain this, and related to their own lives, I'll bet they would come up with all kinds, don't you think so? All kinds of distinctions between the urges they have and the things they do, or what they want to be. And this is more, I'll see if I can catch this, if I can explain it well. The difference between what I would like to be, the ideal me, and what night after night I admit that I really was. We would not explain concupiscence as an appetite running wild, but rather as that to which holds us back from the perfection or good we so desire. That's good. That's good. Fourth, even when we want our lives or acts to be most ideal, we still find them not pure in intention or motive. Good. Now, by the way, let's add this, and I think children can have this pointed out. You don't need to be 60 or 70 years old to finally, at long, dreary last, have somehow conquered this concupiscence. In fact, we can't do it by ourselves anyhow. It's here especially that grace is so powerful. Fifth, we know what is good, we want it, but concupiscence pulls us away from it. Now, if you can exemplify this with children or draw it out of their own lives, I'm sure you'll find all sorts of experiences. Grace and willpower can help man overcome the pull of concupiscence. The pull, the tug, the urge, all kinds of important monosyllables. By the way, you know, most people live their lives on monosyllables. We want this one, but they want to speculate. Then they go into bigger words. Let's see what another one has. How can concupiscence be explained in today's terminology? Stimulus response. Okay. Behaviorism. Well, all right. On the other hand, in terms of, see, there are different levels of concupiscence. You're sure to get them in the right place. Question four. Hope somebody answered it. What is question four, sisters? Do you know what? Nobody seems to have answered it. What is it, sisters? How should evolution be taught consistent with the Christian faith and in keeping with current, say, scientific thought? Well, first of all, it is well to recall, and I think the children or older people too, should be informed that evolution is not a neutral subject. The faith has a vested interest in evolution. Now, it has a vested interest in several ways. First of all, evolution, as understood by many people, is the evolution literally of everything. Everything is in the process of development. Now, faith tells the Christian there are two things you just cannot, and remain a Christian, say, evolved. Both are articles of faith. The first is God, and the second is the human spirit. God is and was perfect God from all eternity. Whatever Kuwe could tell his followers to tell themselves every day, in every way, I'm getting better and better. Not God. He can't say that. He wouldn't be God. The second entity in the universe, which we cannot affirm that it evolved, is the human spirit. Every human spirit is individually, personally, distinctively, separately created by God. And if ever we want to impress ourselves or our students with our individuality, you see what this implies? God steps in, He, the sovereign creator, this is faith, and creates a human soul. No matter what contribution, and this of course is the whole of theology, whatever contribution may have been made, for example, in prior eons before the first man came on the scene. And by the way, I have no difficulty whatsoever with anthropological evolution. Or no matter what contribution may be said that the parents make to this child being what it is, their child. Nevertheless, its spirit had to be at a point of time. There was a profound sense in which, the moment before God created our souls, we were not. We didn't exist. So, first great investment the faith has in making sure that evolution is consistent with the Catholic faith. But secondly, evolution, even of man's body, it is a fine theory, explains a lot of things, but also raises certain problems of the faith. And now the least problem is the one we touched upon rather briskly and I hope somewhat clearly about this polygenism or monogenism. Now there are evolutionists, good ones, who have no difficulty with the monogenetic origin of the human race. They say it doesn't really affect their system. Because, they say, how can you ever prove there was a lineal evolution? That it had to be, for example, well, multitudes, presumably, of lower animals, till finally you had the primates, and finally you had human beings sprouting all over the world simultaneously. That's part of the lineal theory of evolution. Well, says who? Why couldn't it have been? In fact, the mutation theory in genetics seems to favor a sudden cosmic change which could well have affected the genetic system of a single mammal. by the way, is the theory espoused by my confrere and study partner in theology, Paulinus Forstoffel, a Jesuit, who got his doctorate in genetics from Ohio State University. We've spent hours talking about evolution. Polygenetic, monogenetic, doesn't affect us. And one of the difficulties, frankly, with theologians that write learned books raising difficulties for the faith based on scientific theory is that often they are less than well familiar with science. Now the problem there, of course, is to make sure that Christ is the second Adam, and that therefore the human race in the fall of its first parents inherited this sin. Because if you've got all sorts of first parents sprouting up simultaneously, north, south, east, and west, you'd have to have all kinds of atoms falling all over the place, which, to say the least, raises a few problems with St. Paul's letter to the Romans, in which he says, through one man, fifth chapter, sin entered the world, and through one man it was redeemed. Question, that was four, was it? Question five. Are evil moral tendencies inherited? An answer? Yes, though we are not determined to evil. Yes, because of social environment, home influence. Now that, the answer is well done, well given, but I must have not made myself clear enough when I made the question. What I really meant by the question was more than perhaps meets the eye. I am asking whether, in a way comparable to how, for example, physical disabilities can be inherited, privations of various kinds, you know, various tendencies because of the genetic, well, all kinds of complications, depending on the combination which occurs, a child will normally, right, somehow inherit the genetic qualities of its ancestors. My question is there something in the moral order like that? I think there is. In other words, to have been born of, notice, did I say evil moral tendencies? I guess I did. Well, if I had given it more thought, I would have said, are evil or good moral tendencies inherited? Though I suppose I used evil tendencies because I was lecturing somewhat on the theology of sin. In other words, is the fact that there is a certain parent, a mother or a father, with certain psychological, well, makeup which they have, the nervous system which they possess, the various propensities that we are coming to believe are somehow inherited in the physical, right, and psychological order. Is there something like that in the moral order too? I think so. In terms of tendency, now clearly, and this is very well said, we are not determined to evil. But I want to separate that question from the other one, which I thought was rather obvious. Are we exposed to moral evil tendencies in virtue of the environment into which we are born? See? That I think nobody would question. But I was raising the more difficult question as to whether our parentage, our background, the fact that there are skeletons in our closet, could it possibly have an effect on our moral life? I think so. In terms of tendency, nothing else. Now, of course, the tendency is intended by God undoubtedly that we might have things to overcome and thereby become more holy and sanctify ourselves. Question 6. How much does environment determine moral conduct? An observation. We have a great responsibility as teachers to influence society for the good in view of social solidarity spoken of in the lecture. Yes, and I think we are concerned with our own work, and we certainly have enough of it in the classroom. On the other hand, I do think, in fact, I'm sure, we've got to give, even as teachers in the classroom, or say, we as respective communities, ought to be far more concerned than we have been about not just teaching the individual to be good, but helping society to be good. And therefore, all the factors that shape society, take the communications media, how powerful they are for influencing in either direction. I did tell you, didn't I, in a previous conference about the speech that our Father General gave at the Second Vatican Council on communications media? Didn't I? Well, it's very relevant here, because he visited us in the United States a little over a year ago. This is Father Arupe. And after the consolidated mass, he talked to us, to the community assembled, about many things. But then he spent, I'd say, a good half hour on just this question. As you know, a certain number of the fathers of the Second Vatican Council were invited by the directors of the council to give a major address before the assembled prelates. It had to be a concise address with a certain number of minutes they were allowed, and that then would become part of the proceedings of the council on which things would be discussed and voted. He was invited to give a speech and wanted to make sure that he has one shot hit the bullseye. He went to see the Holy Father, Paul VI, and asked for advice. What should I talk about? I've got less than 20 minutes to do it. What should I say? Imagine about the 1,000 things that Pope Paul could have told him to speak on. Without hesitation, the Holy Father said, I think you should speak about communications media. And to point out the good they can do and the harm they are doing. He went back. Father Arupe wrote his speech, brought it back, rough copy, to the Pope. The Pope went over the text, marked it up. The speech of the Second Vatican Council was the joint effort of these two men. No single address in the 4 years of the council aroused more violent hostility from the press of the world than that speech. No wonder. He told us one of the most important missions that the Society of Jesus has in the years to come is to exploit, that's the verb he used, to exploit the communications media, because otherwise we will be teaching individuals and those in control of the media will be shaping society. Now we've got to do both. On the other hand, let's not overlook the second. Did I quote to you Marshall McLuhan's statement on this? Well, as I mentioned, I will be at the University of Ottawa next fall, and I was there for a couple of days, some 2 months ago, to, look over my classes and books and so on. And I came to know a wonderful person there who is editor of a magazine called Christian Communications, John W. Mole. Well, Father Mole, N-O-M-I, is a good friend of Marshall McLuhan, whose observations on the communications media are, as you know, the gospel truth in most circles. At any rate, he showed me a letter, this is Father Mole, that he had just received recently from McLuhan. It was on communications media and what they are doing today. I have memorized this statement of McLuhan's. I wish he would print it. He said, "The communications media of Western society are engaged in a Luciferian conspiracy against the truth." Unquote, Marshall McLuhan. The communications media of Western society are engaged in a Luciferian conspiracy against the truth. We better know it. How then does environment determine moral conduct? The first observation, we have a great responsibility, true, to influence society for the good in view of the social solidarity spoken of in the lecture. In other words, what is happening, and let's spend a minute or two on this. I've spent many hours with John Mole. He's one reason I'm going to Ottawa. When you meet a great mind, you want to be exposed to it for a while. John Mole has analyzed communications media as few men, I think, have in North America. And he is one who has especially pointed out to me and has encouraged me in my work in Eastern religions. He said, until rather recently, human society, even though we talked about nations or cultures, were pretty much scattered individuals. Such awareness, even as they had of each other's presence, was mostly an act of faith. But no more. No more. We don't have to believe there's a California now. We can see California. We can hear it. In other words, our communications media, thanks to the developments of science, have united man in so many ways, in terms of distance and space, practically erased. In fact, you know, they're coming up now with a new definition of space. Moreover, in terms of the communication of thought, not merely is it the intercommunication, but that one single individual with one idea can simultaneously affect the minds of 100 million people. This has never been known before in the history of man. And whoever controls those media controls the world. There's no doubt about it. So we can teach our little classes of 35 students when in the evening, prime time TV, 8:30 in the evening, someone contradicting all that we've said will address 35 million Americans. Now clearly, we cannot ourselves become as involved as perhaps we would want to be. Nevertheless, the importance of keeping this vision clearly alive before the children, from childhood on, from, I was going to say babyhood, from first and second grade, the desire to communicate, to share, and the looking forward to keep a sharp eye on talent. And not, by the way, to necessarily first look for piety. Of course, it's nice if you can have both a person who shows great natural promise and is, say, a good boy or a good girl. But it may be the roustabout, the aggressive person, the one giving you all the trouble, who's extraordinarily gifted as a leader. When one is with a crowd of people who are good, one is more inclined and influenced to the good. In a low moral society, one knows that something is wrong, but the atmosphere of society influences one against his convictions. And here, with this, perhaps we can close, though I'd like to, I think, read one more question. The importance of training young people, and this from early days, of standing on their own. Because, let's face it, we know ourselves. One reason that I entered the Society of Jesus was that I hoped to be in good company. I should add, I have not been disappointed. That's part of the grace of our vocation. Now, by and large, the people in the world, we included, of course, but especially secular, the lay people, cannot really choose their environment, the people among whom they're going to work, or for whom. And consequently, from very early, they don't know what you're preparing them for, but you should. In little ways, that they are able, on the one hand, not to be estranged from others, because, now St. Paul says, if we wanted to do that, we'd have to leave the world. Where do you go? So we can't run away. On the other hand, to teach them to stand by their own convictions, first of all, to have a mind of their own, to challenge them, and to tell them they're going to be constantly challenged. And then, and I've heard teachers tell me this, and I believe it only because they told me, that youngsters, sometimes I understand from grammar school days, can't be prepared to give just little speeches, maybe a half a minute or 1 or 2 minutes long, otherwise they begin to ramble, but to get a message across on certain basic subjects, which they are sure you know later on to be challenged on.